Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Our forward planning is always looking out that you're going to have to make reductions.
Local school districts are making difficult and uncertain choices with next year's funding levels in limbo. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new research shows particular species of kelp absorb pollutants in the environment around them.
So if we have a lot of kelp in the water, we potentially have a better quality in the water column.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
One person died Friday in a roof collapse at a South Anchorage gym. The Anchorage Daily News reported that Turnagain CrossFit was holding a fitness competition Friday evening when the roof collapsed. More than 24 people were in the building. Most people ran out, the ADN reports, but 3 were trapped inside. One of them was able to get out on their own and was treated at the scene. Authorities said another was extricated by members of an Anchorage Fire Department search and rescue team and was taken to the hospital. A third person was found dead in the collapse. Authorities have not yet publicly identified the person killed. An online fundraiser described the woman as a mother of 3 who had gone to work out that evening with her gym family. The cause of the roof collapse remained under investigation this weekend. The Anchorage Office of Emergency Management cautioned residents that the city has had near record snow conditions this winter, and residents should consider the snow load on their roofs. Officials also warned that residents should exercise extreme caution if removing snow from their roofs themselves. The Anchorage School Board is set to vote tomorrow on its budget for the upcoming school year. The vote comes after months of unease from community members over what cuts the district would have to make to close a projected $48 million budget deficit. But as Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, the board's vote also comes at a time of a lot of uncertainty around how much funding the state legislature will send to schools.
For months, Anchorage school officials have talked about how to fill their budget gap. Its latest estimate is around $48 million. At one point, the district considered cutting gifted and virtual learning programs and outsourcing swimming and hockey facilities. ASD Chief Financial Officer Andy Ratliff says the district didn't think all of the cuts would happen.
We knew a lot of them wouldn't be acceptable to the community, but really wanted to just highlight what those additive costs are so everyone is aware what we spend our money on.
Instead, the school board will vote on a budget at their next meeting that largely relies on using the district savings and one-time state and federal funding to fill the projected budget gap.
In order to maintain operations and have education look similar to what it has in the past, we've used all those one-time funds, but it's really going to come due the following year when we no longer have any more one-time funds.
While the proposed budget no longer eliminates big programs, it would increase the pupil-to-teacher ratio by 1 next school year. That essentially means on average class sizes would go up. Additional cuts come from closing 2 elementary schools.
We did close Abbott Loop, and in our budget, Ursa Major is also closed. That was closed this year due to structural deficiencies in the building that were identified, and those students were moved out to Aurora and Orion elementary schools.
While the Anchorage School Board follows its timeline for approving its budget, big uncertainty still looms. School districts across Alaska are closely watching the legislature, where lawmakers are debating an increase to the base student allocation or how much state funding each district gets per student. The BSA is currently $5,930 and hasn't been increased since 2016. Governor Mike Dunleavy's proposed budget increases the amount by $30, a bump of about 0.5 percentage point. Ratliff says the flat funding from the state in recent years, which hasn't kept up with inflation, has made it difficult for districts to plan their budgets ahead of time.
Our forward planning is always looking out that you're going to have to make reductions. There's nothing that says we're going to have the same number of people for the same number of students going forward so we can, you know, shift our services and try to provide it. It's always in a mode of, okay, we're going to have to, you know, inflation's going to cost $15, $20 million next year. How are we going to make up that difference?
There is potential relief ahead. One of the proposals in the Alaska legislature would increase the BSA by $1,000. It was brought forward in the Senate Education Committee, chaired by Anchorage Senator Lukey Tobin. Tobin says that figure comes after the Alaska Association of School Boards said that an increase of about $860 would catch schools up with years of inflation.
That number they projected would help bring them up to current funding and meet the 24.6% projected inflation that has eroded the value of the current BSA.
Tobin says that lawmakers are currently tweaking the bill so it would also keep up with inflation. She says she hopes that the $1,000 increase would help to bolster schools rather than just catch them up.
Adding back some guidance counseling or potentially mental health services or reinstituting elective classes that have been cut or adding that extra AP math course. The extra money was meant to really infuse education, to put blood back into an atrophied system.
While it's still early in the legislative session, Tobin says she's confident that a substantial BSA increase will be signed into law this year. If the BSA were boosted by $1,000, Ratliff with the Anchorage School District says it would mean about $73 million more for the district.
That'd be allow us to add some of the things back and or put money back in savings, because our budget this for next year is really heavily reliant on the use of our savings accounts.
After the Anchorage School Board votes on the budget Tuesday night, it heads to the city for approval. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
A series of broken rules and an environment of sloppy oversight led up to a Humvee crash last year that killed a young woman from Eagle River. That's according to facts laid out in an Air Force accident investigation report released last week. It's the first public, detailed account from the military about what was happening on its Idaho base leading up to 19-year-old Air Force ROTC cadet Mackenzie Wilson's death on June 24th. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
Wilson was one of 19 cadets chosen for a four-day ROTC event at Idaho's Mountain Home Air Force Base last summer. On the last day of the event, the report says the untrained cadets were given unsupervised access to drive old Humvees, Humvees that were intended only for use as targets at Sailor Creek Bombing Range. At one point, Wilson and two other cadets took turns behind the wheel of a Humvee doing donuts. Wilson was killed minutes later when the Humvee she was riding in flipped on an unnamed gravel road. Idaho is prosecuting the cadet who was behind the wheel for manslaughter, but after months of Wilson's mother pleading for answers, it's still unclear if the military will take any disciplinary action against its own personnel or make any changes to its base operations. Wilson's mother, Jessica Swan, says she is profoundly devastated and that Air Force leadership was acutely negligent. Air Force officials say they are committed to apply lessons from the investigation to prevent future mishaps. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a ceremony at Elizabeth Paradovich's alma mater celebrates her legacy.
We're all just so grateful for what she has done.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Emergency service personnel rescued an injured person early Saturday morning who'd apparently fallen off the Tanana River Bridge at Big Delta, about 8 miles north of Delta Junction. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
Alaska State Troopers say they got a report at around 5:45 a.m. Saturday that a woman had fallen off the bridge and was laying on an ice shelf about 30 feet below. Troopers and Delta Junction area emergency personnel responded and set up a rescue operation on the bridge and closed the Richardson Highway to traffic intermittently for about an hour and a half while the operation was underway. A Fort Greely EMS responder who's been trained in so-called high-angle rescues was lowered off one side of the bridge down to the ice, where he checked out the victim and secured her in an apparatus that lifted her back up to the bridge. Delta medical transport personnel then took the victim to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, where she was listed in critical condition. Troopers didn't identify the victim in the report posted Saturday evening, and a spokesperson said Sunday they aren't providing any additional information while they're investigating the circumstances under which the victim fell off the bridge, including why she was there and how it happened. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A new study shows that twice as many pregnant or recently pregnant women in Alaska died in 2021 as compared to recent years. The Alaska Beacon reports the new data gives a more detailed view of maternal mortality at a time when Governor Mike Dunleavy has proposed increasing Medicaid coverage for new mothers. The Alaska Maternal Child Death Review, which produced the study, believes many of the deaths may be preventable. Preventable deaths occur for various reasons, notably access to health care, pregnancy-related deaths increased most in rural areas of Alaska, where some residents seeking care were unable to access it. Factors like interpersonal violence, mental health problems, substance abuse, and lack of health care contributed to the increased maternal mortality in Alaskans, the causes of which are complex. Of those who died in 2021, over half had a history of interpersonal violence. While the overall mortality rate has more than doubled, experts say the number may not be telling the whole story. Many of the deaths recorded may be linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition, the small numbers make it difficult to draw conclusions. Alaska is not the only state to see an increase in maternal deaths. The rest of the nation also saw an increase in pregnancy-associated deaths from 2018 to 2020. Some of the recommendations made by the Alaska Maternal Child Death Review include advocating for more programs to screen for potential victims of interpersonal violence and homicide. One expert also mentioned the importance of local care workers such as doulas and community birth workers who may be able to offer more culturally responsible care to help lower the rate of maternal deaths. Kelp grows naturally throughout Alaska's waterways and is also grown and harvested by an expanding commercial seaweed industry. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, new research shows kelp has ecological benefits by absorbing pollution in the water.
Although slippery strands of kelp aren't plants, they can pull carbon and nitrogen from their surrounding environment just like a forest on land. New research from the University of Alaska Fairbanks shows some species of kelp may be especially effective at taking in nitrogen from the water. In other words, kelp may be able to help clean up polluted waterways.
For some species, they are kind of like a sponge.
Marine ecologist Sherry Umansor is an assistant professor at UAF and led the study.
So if there is a lot, they can absorb a lot. But for some species, that sponge behavior is a little bit, it saturates faster. So for example, it doesn't matter if there is a lot, it can only absorb so much.
Umansor says it seems like ribbon kelp is more sensitive to nitrogen in the water, so it's a better sponge, while sugar kelp is more slow and steady. To gather data, Umansor worked with kelp farmers who grew sugar and ribbon kelp side by side. The farmers collected tissue samples and water samples every 30 days until the kelp was harvested, and then sent all the samples to Umansor's lab.
By looking at the changes in water over time, I was able to relate this to the changes nutrients in the tissue to get an understanding how much they vary one versus the other one.
Pulling carbon from water into kelp isn't a new idea, and just this year, Governor Mike Dunleavy proposed a law to update Alaska's regulations to capitalize on carbon credit markets, where the carbon-collecting power of Alaska's underground areas, forests, and kelp could be sold to investors or organizations. But Umansor says her research indicates that the nitrogen-removing properties of kelp are the more compelling finding from the study.
The difference between having a lot of carbon and a lot of nitrogen in the water is that carbon is not a contaminant, but nitrogen is. So really, a lot of nitrogen can produce these algal blooms or PSP, if you're familiar, so the blooms that cause the shellfish poisoning. So this is also driven by excess nutrients. So if we have a lot of kelp in the water, we potentially have a better quality in the water column.
Carbon sequestration, or the process of capturing and storing carbon from the atmosphere, and nitrogen removal happen on very different timelines.
Sequestration is not something that can happen from one month to another. It has to happen in hundreds of years. While nitrogen removal, to avoid contamination, is something that can happen literally in weeks or months.
There are plenty of potential directions to go with the knowledge that kelp can help lower nitrogen levels in the water. Umansor says one could be a mutually beneficial relationship between kelp and salmon hatcheries.
Perhaps we can, leverage to some extent the nitrogen that is excreted in the salmon hatcheries and actually grow kelp in it, right? And then we will have a win-win. We will produce biomass from kelp that can then be processed to produce products, and we will be cleaning the water at the same time.
That's an exciting idea for people in the mariculture industry like Hannah Wilson, who's the development director of the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation. While coastal Alaska Native people have used seaweeds for centuries, commercial cultivation is a relatively new phenomenon. She says there was a 200% increase in pounds of seaweed sold for 2020 and 2021. Wilson says some of that could be pandemic-related market depression, but it's still an upward trajectory.
Currently, the industry really is focused on food markets, and I think there's definitely interest in people growing at a larger scale, maybe for things more like animal feed, kind of maybe like a less high-quality product, but a larger volume, just trying to kind of diversify that industry.
While there aren't very many commercial seaweed farms in Alaska right now, and the state is still working to set up regulatory frameworks and funding resources to help new farmers, the burgeoning industry is taking off. Wilson says learning more about the potential ecological benefits of kelp farming is a way the industry can potentially diversify. There's a slew of funding heading to the state to support mariculture growth. And beyond that, more than $75 million in funding for mariculture, Umansor says her research also points to the value of kelp, whether it's on a farm or growing wild. There are benefits to having healthy kelp overall.
I think that we have in Alaska a great opportunity to actually tackle some common problems using smart solutions that are environmentally friendly.
From her position, often on a boat, Umansor says she sees many opportunities for kelp to come. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
President Joe Biden has named an Alaskan as the nation's first U.S. Arctic ambassador. Michael Schfraga, who currently chairs the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, a Biden appointment in 2021. Schfraga, who is considered an expert on Arctic geography and policy, has been a longtime advocate of using indigenous knowledge to better understand the science of the Arctic. He has served in a number of national leadership roles that involve the Arctic and helped to found the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Schfraga was also a vice chancellor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and a faculty member. He earned the first PhD in Geography and Northern Studies from UAF.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Alaska Pacific University offers an education as an adventure in living and learning. Students are the core of APU, representing the aspirations and collective wisdom of our community. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Alaska's Indigenous heritage while offering a unique and powerful educational experience. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The vote to recognize a historic Alaska Native civil rights leader in the U.S. Senate last week was unanimous. The resolution designates February 16th as Elizabeth Paratovich Day for her role in winning passage of the nation's first anti-discrimination law in 1945. Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan introduced the measure. Murkowski, in her remarks on the Senate floor, said Paratovich and her husband Roy's campaign for the bill raised awareness about many injustices.
And they pointed out the simple fact that Alaska Natives were paying taxes for a public school system, the same public school system that excluded their very own children. They pointed out that Alaska Native men were fighting in World War II. And then when they returned from the war, those Alaska Native veterans were denied rights that others enjoyed.
When Paratovich and her husband moved to Juneau to fight for civil rights, they were turned away from housing because they were Tlingit. Murkowski called Paratovich a pretty extraordinary woman who was not afraid to stand up to racism, an inspiration, she says, to speak out and take action whenever you see an injustice. Senator Dan Sullivan said in a statement that Paratovich deserves national recognition, a place in the company of the nation's foremost civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. and Susan B. Anthony. Ketchikan turned out to show support for Paratovich last week. KRBD's Reagan Miller stopped by a community feast at Paratovich's alma mater, Ketchikan High School.
Elizabeth Paratovich graduated from Ketchikan High School in 1931, and her influence was clear during an event honoring her in the school's commons. Yesh Atuwu Ginger McCormick is the vice president of Alaska Native Brotherhood Camp 14, who helped put the event together. She said it was something of a homecoming.
It's not meant to be so formal and educational. It's really about to celebrate and welcome Elizabeth back home as alumni.
Ketchikan High School's commons were packed with people gathered for a herring egg feast and proclamation signing in honor of Paratovich. Children dressed in regalia ran through the school pounding on drums, members of the Alaska Native Sisterhood and Alaska Native Brotherhood danced, and everyone enjoyed herring eggs. The event was co-hosted by Camp 14 of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood and the cultural coordinator for Ketchikan School District, Teresa Varnell. Officials from local tribes and municipalities came together to sign a joint proclamation in her honor. Borough Mayor Rodney Dial gave a short speech.
Every century or so, if a place is truly blessed, we get a person who rises to that special level of being the transformational change that impacts society forever. Elizabeth Paratovich was one of those people.
There were guest speakers like Master Carver Nathan Jackson, who is from the same clan as Paratovich. He played his harmonica in her memory. The event also featured the reveal of an approximately 20-foot-wide banner commemorating important events in the fight for civil rights. It'll hang from the second floor of the school's commons. Peter Stanton, a Ketchikan High School history teacher, also spoke about the importance of the event and how big of an impact Paratovich had on history. Stanton is on sabbatical this year, writing a book about Tlingit history.
She is the most famous fighter for social justice of her generation, and deservedly so. But she was not the only fighter before or since. Let's remember today all of the struggles for justice that so many people on this land have been, are, and will be fighting for, past, present, and future.
Cynthia Lannis, the treasurer for Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 14, said it was special to see kids honor Paratovich through music and dance.
The fact that they were proud that they were doing it, you know, it was their drums, it was their singing, and to have these little, preschool, kindergarten kids come out, makes me smile when I see all these little guys out there just doing their thing.
Peyton McEwane goes to Ketchikan Charter School, and she played the drums during the celebration. She said she's been learning words in the Haida language with her class.
There's a few words I learned in their Haida language, or their Tsintsian language. Ama hupo means good night. I think that's how you say it.
When asked what brought them to the event, Nina Hopps and her daughters said it was twofold, a love of herring eggs and a love for Elizabeth Paratovich. She homeschools her daughters and wants them to learn about the trailblazers that she didn't as a student.
I'm learning right along with them, and that all the parts of our history and all the parts of Alaska that I didn't know about and that was not part of my education, we're making it an effort to be part of their education.
Judy Lise Guthrie, a Ketchikan Indian Community Tribal Council member, says she spent the day talking to her grandchildren about what they learned about Paratovich.
I got to hear about what they got to do in their classes, and so that was really neat.
And at the end of the day, Guthrie says Paratovich was a true inspiration for everyone.
We look at Elizabeth Paratovich as being one of us, but one who fought for us when no one else would. She was there. And we're all just so grateful for what she has done for the Indian communities in Alaska, but also for the non-Indian people who live here and who get to learn about what she's done for us.
It's a legacy that's alive and well in Ketchikan. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Kodiak could soon have its first cannabis cafe. The details are still cloudy, but as KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, if approved, it would be one of only three licensed on-site cannabis consumption venues within the state of Alaska.
Janice Stevens is one of the owners of Wildflower, a dispensary on Kodiak's Near Island. She says the concept is simple, a space where customers can legally consume marijuana, like in coffee drinks, with an option to add droplets of THC or CBD, some mocktails, and maybe a few coloring books for anyone looking to pass time on a rainy afternoon.
Something different for people to maybe go to before dinner or hang out and visit.
She says it wouldn't be very big. Less than a dozen people could be in the cafe at once. State law mandates that customers need to be 21 and older, and the building has to be a standalone structure, separate from the dispensary itself. Steven says she's considering converting a shipping container or a greenhouse into a cafe space for Wildflower's parking lot. But any design ideas are still in the early phases.
I would like something with a lot of light, neat flooring, some cool chairs.
She still needs to get approval from the borough as well, but the state has greenlit her business license and Kodiak City Council voiced its support as long as she builds to code. If it all comes together, it would only be the state's third sanctioned establishment for on-site consumption of cannabis. The other two are in Ketchikan and Fairbanks. Alaska was the first state in the country to legalize recreational use of marijuana at certain venues like cafes back in 2019. That's the same year Stevens opened Wildflower. And she says since then, she's heard locals and tourists say they want to hang out somewhere other than a bar. More and more states have legalized weed over the years, and Stevens says changing attitudes around marijuana means it's less taboo.
I think that it's going to be an odd concept at first, but I see it in the next few years catching on to being more normalized and just kind of another thing to do in our community.
If all goes according to plan, she says it would likely be a year before she could open her new business venture. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Tegan Hanlon, Wesley Early, Jeremy Shea, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, Sage Smiley in Wrangell, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, and Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us, news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Chris Hyde. Madeline Rose produced tonight's program, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. Would you like to play a part in the public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.